Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
This week on Ask Dr. Dawn, we'll be talking about science and the brain, but before we go there, I wanted to give you some comments on the vaccine situation in the United States and elsewhere. Now in the United States, in the wake of the recent Janssen COVID-19 approval, that's Johnson & Johnson to those of you who didn't get the memo that we're calling it something else now, we have three vaccines. And everybody's reporting the negative. It really seems like that when I read the news or go online. And please understand, that's due to the attention economy. In news, if it bleeds, it leads. And so I think we should be happier and feeling better than we actually are, because I don't think we're getting the straight story. More about that in a moment. But there's other dynamics at work here. Meanwhile, the bureaucrats and the politicians are very worried about their own futures if they make a mistake. Is the current messes in California with a recall attempt for the governor and the New York, kerfluffle show, for politicians, there is no choice that doesn't risk a huge backlash. When decisive action is called for in a situation where information is incomplete, people are going to get it wrong. Let's stop with the Monday morning quarterbacking. These stories are actually likely to slow down the decisiveness that we actually mean. A case in point, France versus England on the matter of vaccination. Maybe it's because Boris got sick. Maybe it's because France's vaccine effort failed to launch. But France has only vaccinated 3 million people as of February 28th. That's about 7% of their population. The UK has vaccinated 20 million. That's 30% of their population. So what's going on here in France? Well, Macron put his pied solidly in his bouche, that's foot in his mouth, by the way, by saying in last January that AstraZeneca was virtually useless in people over 65. Absence of evidence does not mean the same thing as evidence of absence, Monsieur le Président. And unfortunately, well, they were concerned that older people wouldn't get a good function of the vaccine, so they didn't vaccinate older people. I'm talking about this, the lack of data, the requirement to go out on a limb, and there were also organizational issues in France that created a lot of problems. For example, if you look at their vaccination rate, it dropped on the weekend, and that's very different from most other countries. The UK cases and the hospitalizations have plummeted in late January and early February. Hospitalizations are down 80%, that's 80%, 3 to 4 weeks post vaccine in people who are 80 plus years. That's huge, because those were the people who are dying. It's 85% for Pfizer and 94% for the AstraZeneca when you look at all comers. This is for hospitalization. It's amazing. Israel is showing the same thing. In fact, Israel just began vaccinating those Palestinians who have travel permits to come into Israel. Maybe we should start thinking about pivoting a little bit in the United States with this policy of one vaccine and then worry later about getting the second booster shot. I think we could reach a lot of people and maybe quash this. And I hope that this British data that just came out is going to cause the United States to reconsider their strategy of holding back vaccination for the second dose. Johnson & Johnson's going to ride to the rescue a little bit there, but we've got a lot stockpiled that we're holding back, and I think we should really think in the light of this British information about widening our net, so to speak. And maybe we should think about helping Mexico instead of telling them, too bad, so sad, not our problem. Well, actually, given the length of the Mexican United States border, it is our problem. And easing up on all of those poor, locked out asylum seekers at the border is justice. It is the right thing to do. It's fine as long as we vaccinate and quarantine anyone coming in for 2 weeks. I'm sure that San Diego has plenty of vacancies in their destination hotels. Which brings me to another commentary. Recent research shows that levels of COVID are extremely low in that those 5% of people who have gotten vaccinated, who actually got the disease, got light to asymptomatic cases, and they were only contagious for 2 or 3 days, which is a huge improvement. So what do we do about the vaccine haves and the have-nots? After a year of being shunned because they might be carriers of COVID-19, medical workers are now emerging as their own sort of enormous pod of people who can be reasonably secure to be around or to travel. Will COVID testing be waived for them on air travel? And how do we balance privacy rights if we try to create some kind of vaccination pass? And how do we avoid pressure for counterfeiting on that pass? Now, these are problems that need to be thought about and dealt with. And the whole world is struggling with the next question, which this is one of them, in the COVID-19-iverse with vaccine. Now, one thing that hasn't happened yet, although it's early days, is a lot of anti-vax demonstrations at vaccine centers. There was one big one at the Dodger Stadium mass vax, but I haven't seen a lot more happening there. And I had really worried about picketers like we see in front of Planned Parenthood or like we saw around the vote counting centers last November. But that didn't emerge. And as more and more people get vaccinated and don't die, grow a third eyeball, other people are wanting to get vaccinated. And so the next issue, as you've probably heard, is that that's just not that easy, even if you qualify under the guidelines. So for all of you who do qualify, and for those of you who shortly will, I want to emphasize that you must be persistent. You must keep trying. Do not give up. It's sort of like if you hit a wall, try again, knock on the same door the following day, and it may have opened up. If you are 65 plus, you're eligible in California and in all states. And soon, people who are 16 years to 64 who have cancer, Down syndrome, diabetes with a hemoglobin A1C of greater than 7.5 will also be eligible. I don't know when this will be, but this is coming down the pike. People with severe asthma, emphysema are also on the list. Now, you'll need proof in the form of an attestation by a doctor. That form, yet to be fully designed, and it's not clear whether a letter on letterhead will fly, although the local public health department says that it might. So what are you going to do right now? If you're 65 and over, my recommendation is you start at your state Department of Public Health and see if you qualify. If you are in a quote-unquote target area, we're vaccinating many, many teachers at any age, but it goes through the employer and the arrangements are made kind of off the grid. So go to your public health department and see whether you qualify. You may, in fact, qualify. So check the state website and then start hunting. And even if you're out of state, pharmacy websites that are distributing vaccine are available in the link at Ask Dr. Don. Just click on the resources tab on the far left and look for the link titled Santa Cruz County Health Services. That, scroll down when you get there, and you will find a grid with links to the Rite Aid, CVS, and other websites for local people in Santa Cruz County. Also, links to OptumServe. And I am encouraging you to try to get that appointment. My patients are being very successful, but they have to keep pushing and you have to keep checking. For the pharmacies, you can go to a different county and that's not a problem. If it's a vaccination through your county health department, you have to show residency. And rules vary and the interpretation of them vary. It's very chaotic right now. But remember, the underlying goal is to get you vaccinated. Everybody wants to get you vaccinated. So let's just keep trying. And I want to throw out a shout out, 4 stars to CVS for a very usable national website that allows you to pick state and then scroll through counties. And it tells you, you know, are they all booked up? Do they have options available? And you simply just have to keep knocking on the door. But the door will open and the vaccines become available shortly. We'll have an executive from Blue Shield and whatever organization he's created on order of the governor doing the distribution to the sites. And I have no idea what that's going to look like. So I would say now is your moment, because we're probably looking for another splash of chaos sometime soon. We're going to move now to some science. The first one is something extremely heartening for a disease that up until now has been impossible to treat and essentially a death sentence. And that disease is ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Northwestern University scientists have identified the first compound that eliminates the ongoing degeneration of upper motor neurons that have become diseased. And this is a key contributor to ALS, which is a swift and fatal neurodegenerative disease that paralyzes its victims, including their diaphragm. If you live long enough with ALS, you will end up on a ventilator, unable to speak, and having to communicate by looking at a screen with your eyeballs. This is not a happy disease. In the ALS, the movement-initiating cells in the brain, like when I think about moving my left arm, those motor neurons fire. And in fact, the Neuralink, that pet project of, amongst others, of Elon Musk, has successfully done that with a monkey, basically getting into the arm motor upper motor neurons on the surface of the brain, such that the monkey can move a cursor on a computer to, I believe what they did was just, you know, ask for a banana, click here. Monkey learned how to ask for a banana by imagining that he was pushing on the cursor, and with biological learning, not machine learning, those neurons in the monkey actually managed to make the leap. And this is wonderful and has all kinds of potential for dealing with spinal cord injuries. But getting back to ALS, there's essentially two sets of motor neurons that get damaged, the ones in the brain that go from the brain to the spinal cord, and the ones in the spinal cord that go from the spinal cord to the end organ, that is to say, the muscle that you're trying to move. So far, there's been no treatment for the brain component of ALS. This is one of the early things that happens in ALS. So this all got started, let's see, it was published in Clinical and Translational Medicine, February 23rd, 2021. Study author is Silverman. If you go Silverman, Northwestern Clinical and Translational Medicine, you can find the article without wading through Google Scholar and its embarrassment of riches when you're trying to find something specific. So Silverman identified a compound which is called NU9, and it was developed in his lab to reduce protein misfolding in cell culture lines. The compound is not toxic, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier. So this is extraordinarily exciting. The compound addresses the two important factors that cause the upper motor neurons to become diseased and fail: protein misfolding and protein clumping inside the cell. Sound familiar? Both Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease are essentially neuron damage because of protein clumping. Now, proteins fold in a very specific way in order to function. When they misfold, they become extremely toxic to the neurons. You all may remember mad cow disease. Mad cow disease is a prion. This is a fascinating thing. It's a misfolded protein, but it's contagious. So if you get this misfolded protein in your brain, it will cause the similar protein in your brain that you need to misfold. It's like a magnet pulling something out of alignment, and then it doesn't snap back into alignment. So once these proteins aggregate, they create a pathology, and this happens in about 90% of Alzheimer's disease. And as I said, it's not uniquely in Alzheimer's. So the researchers were using a mouse model in which they gave the mice NU9, and these mice were designed to develop ALS, and they didn't. The scientists went, oh, that's cool. What's going on here? And we now move from mice into cell culture. So after the administration of the NU9, both the mitochondria of the neurons and the endoplasmic reticulum, and that's the protein producer, started to look more normal. The motor neurons were more intact in the cell culture. The dendrites were not full of holes. Their cell bodies were normal size. And in fact, they stopped generating so much that they became similar to healthy control neurons after about 60 days of treatment. Now, we're back to more toxicology and more pharmacokinetics, but it's almost inevitable that a phase one human clinical trial will result sometime in the next couple of years. The fact that this drug has such low toxicity, the fact that you've got an early evidence of benefit in a mouse model. Now remember, it could still fail because Alzheimer's disease mice don't have Alzheimer's disease. They have a genetically created edit that causes them to accumulate beta amyloid. And unfortunately, many drugs that have been tested and worked really well on these mutant mice have failed spectacularly in humans. So the fact that there's good cell culture evidence and the fact that this is low toxicity makes me feel like I can come to you with something this preliminary without being disingenuous and it being another fail. I think this one has serious potential. Our next story is about the brain and altered connectivity after prolonged anesthesia. Prolonged anesthesia, also known as medically induced coma, is a life-saving procedure. It's carried out all across the globe on millions of people in ICUs every year. Sometimes the brain is placed into a state of deep unconsciousness, and this is done beyond short-term anesthesia because of some kind of toxicity, because in case of COVID patients, you're going to be on a ventilator for 3 or 4 weeks. And it's common for family members to report that after hospital discharge, their loved ones were, well, just not quite the same. I've had this experience with several patients that spent a month in the ICU and came through. God bless the staff of the ICU. It's very hard to keep someone alive on a vent that long. But common side effects include lasting cognitive impairment, confusion, memory loss that can last for years or indefinitely. So the lead author, Michael Wenzler, of this study, which was published in PNAS, but I don't know what that stands for, so please excuse me for that. They looked at what's going on in the brains. So the researchers set up a miniature ICU-like platform for mice, of course, and they performed continuous anesthesia for up to 40 hours, many times longer than the longest animal study to date, which is only 6 hours. So they did in vivo, that it means a live two-photon microscopy. This is a new type of neuroimaging that can visualize live brain structures at the micron resolution. Just for reference, a red blood cell is 6 microns across. So you can look at the neurons very, very clearly and see what they look like. And this allows them to look at synapses in the sensory cortex, the area of the brain responsible for processing bodily sensations. They combined this with repeated assessments of the mouse of the behavior of the cortex in these mice. And what they found was that if it's short-term anesthesia, like 6 hours, the connections between the neurons remain stable, but prolonged anesthesia alters the architecture of the synapse. This means, I think, that if you're not allowed to think because of the anesthesia for long periods of time, it's like not watering your synapses. Thought is what keeps those synapses alive. And if you don't let the person think, they basically experience die-off and drop leaves and branches, if you want to think of it as a tree. This is something that hasn't been thought of with a medically induced coma. Anesthesias are not really tailored to patients. Maybe we need to now look at which one causes the least damage. I also wonder if we might be able to use other techniques for stimulation of the brains of people while they were under anesthesia. I understand that we might be able to do that through the auditory pathways, just kind of basically play music, maybe play podcasts of stories, but keep the brain working at some level to avoid this clinical die-off. In other words, keep watering the neurons. Now, the PNAS is Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They're really, I think, doing me a great service by a lot of free material. You know, that paywall that has existed for so long and that I beat my head against on a regular basis when I go and look at an article and discover it's going to cost me $70 to rent it for the show, given that we don't advertise and we don't have any kind of paywall on our website, you know, I can't quite swing that. But a lot of journals during COVID have figured out that they really need to share information and that that is in fact their mission. And I'm seeing a reframing that I greatly welcome and I hope will persist after we get on top of this thing, because it's like the next thing is just around the corner, or might be, or maybe it'll be another 100 years. Who can say? But we need to test those anesthetics with the understanding that there is a cost to this technique that we've been doing, thinking that we were protecting the brain. I want to emphasize that. These periods of prolonged anesthesia, we thought we were helping the person. We thought we were resting their brain. It's a standard thing that you do during encephalitis. And, you know, maybe we need to think about that. And certainly we need to reboot and go do some epidemiology on people who have had this to see exactly how strong this effect is. Because remember, this is based on anecdotal reports of family. We have an idea of the magnitude of it in mice. We are mammals together, so it's probably important. The older you are, in my opinion, the more you should opt out of general anesthesia if you possibly can, particularly if you have a family history of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I would strongly suggest this. Or if you have problems processing drugs, you're one of those canary people who gets drug side effects really easily. You know, if you have to have surgery, you have to have surgery. But maybe you can do it with conscious sedation and a spinal. And as you're selecting your surgery, it may be time to not get too elegant. And I always advise people, when you're having that conversation with a surgeon, you know, a couple good questions. How many times have you done this particular procedure? When did you last do it? How many of these do you do in a year? And I'm going to add another question to my triad there. How long am I going to be under? What can I do to make that as brief as possible? Like, for example, following the instructions about avoiding anticoagulant agents prior to your surgery. Oh, and I need to say one thing. You get a conversation with the anesthesiologist the night before, and that would be a good time to bring up this issue and lobby for a different approach, and also lobby that anesthesiologist to demand of the pharmaceutical manufacturers that they fund this research so that we can see whether they are all alike or whether there's certain anesthetics that might be better. Now, I want to emphasize that dying back of the neurons is from prolonged anesthesia. And we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about general anesthesia as all. And certainly in people who already have neurological compromise of any kind, we do see effects after just a normal surgery length. And I've had that reported to my patients. If you look at the Parkinson's websites, there's lots of anecdotal reports of worsening of the Parkinson's disease in the wake of a general anesthesia. By the way, it turns out that these inhaled anesthetic gases are actually really hard on the environment, and they contribute to global warming. So releasing less of them and capturing the gases differently so that they don't float up into the atmosphere would probably be an excellent idea. Remember when we thought the genome had junk DNA? And then we learned that this junk was actually the operating system for the whole machinery of gene transcription and translation. Well, it may turn out that that random noise on an EEG that we've always thought was just noise may in fact be the trail of the actual operating system for brain function. The brain's neural activity is quite irregular, changing from one moment to the next. You've probably seen pictures of alpha waves and beta waves and theta waves. If you want to go look at them, you can see that there's really quite a lot of variability. And of course, we've talked about heart rate variability in the past and the importance of having a regular variability of your heart as a way to indicate that there's balance between the parasympathetic and the sympathetic branches of the nervous system. The noise was just thought to be natural variations or measurement error, but now researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development have shown that this neural variability may provide a very unique window into brain function. This new perspective article came out in this month's journal Neuron. This activity, as I said, varies quite a lot. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower, sometimes it's rhythmic. And averaging brain activity has been the standard way of visualizing how the brain works. And so these irregular, seemingly random patterns have been disregarded. But such irregularities in the nerve activity appear regardless. This is important, whether you're looking at a single neuron or an entire brain region. So it looked like the brain was always noisy. So what does the changes in that moment-to-moment variability reveal? Well, it's taken about 10 years, but researchers at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development and the Max Planck Institute for Psychiatry and Aging Research have examined the brain's noise systematically, and they've learned how to decode it, showing that the neural variability has a great influence, a direct influence on behavior. The idea that neural variability represents an undervalued key for understanding brain-behavior relationships, in fact, I think it's a key to adaptation. So this recent study sort of proves the concept. This was done with EEG, and the patient's brain activity was measured. So their EEG was measured while they responded to very faint visual targets. This is a really interesting thing in psychology, and I just want to take a moment to talk about it a little bit, because we see this all the time. It has a lot of applications, for example, on police work and some of the other decision-making criteria that we were talking about. It has to do with, are you going to be punished for being wrong, or are you going to be punished for being slow? And the way this works is you put a person in a dim room. This, by the way, was originally used to study the sensitivity of the human eye. So I'm a college student, and they put me in a very dark room, and they show me a very dim light, and they tell me, okay, you're going to tell me when you see the light. Tell me when you see the light. Okay, so you get a baseline. Now they tell me, you know, I only want you to tell me that when you're sure you see the light. And in fact, if you tell me there's a light when there isn't a light, you're going to lose a point. So what happens then is that you've got skin in the game, and you don't want to lose that point. So you wait a little longer to be sure you see the light. On the other hand, if I set the reward thing up and say, you know, I'm going to deduct a point for every time I show you the light and you miss it, well, then you're going to get a lot of false positives. Is this starting to make sense on how the human cognitive error maps? Well, here's the thing. You can see it in the brain, and by decoding the EEG, you can figure out which state the brain is in. When people were told to detect as many targets as possible, the neural variability increased. Whereas when people were asked to avoid mistakes, the neural variability downregulated. People were different in their ability to do this. Those who were better able to adapt their neural variability to these tasks performed better on the task. The better the brain can regulate its noise, the better it can process unknown information and react to it. So our traditional ways of looking at the brain simply threw out the junk, but the junk turns out to be really important. I think all junk is important in science. I think we just have to say, okay, let's save that data for when we're smarter and can understand it. Our next story, that is, given that we understand that this meta system, this meta operating system exists, do we have a tool that will allow us to pull the levers on brain cell function to improve memory or concentration? Well, it seems like maybe we can. In a new study, again, Northwestern, they're cropping up quite a lot on brain research. Scientists improved memory of complex realistic events by applying transcranial magnetic stimulation to the brain network responsible for memories. They then had the participants watch videos of realistic activity to see how memory works during everyday functioning. You might remember that you ate cereal for breakfast, but do you remember what color bowl you ate it out of? Or do you recall watching your partner put the milk away but can't remember on which shelf they put it? Well, this new study improved memory of complex, realistic events similar to those by applying transcranial magnetic stimulation to the brain network responsible for memory. On a day-to-day basis, we must remember complex events that involve many elements, such as different locations, people, and objects. If you've got a lot of things coming at you at once, you're going to filter. And the question is, are you forming a memory trace, or can you form a better one of the sort of peripheral events? And they were able to show in this study, said lead author Melissa Hebscher, that memory for complex, realistic events improved in a safe and non-invasive way using brain stimulation. This came out in the February 4th issue of Current Biology. The study's authors used TMS with the goal of altering brain activity and memory for realistic events. Immediately following stimulation, subjects performed a memory task while having their brains scanned using functional magnetic resonance imaging. So first you go into a big magnetic device that focused down there on the hippocampus at the base of your brain, and then you went and did a memory task. So they watched videos of everyday activities, such as someone folding laundry or taking out the garbage, and they used the video clips because they were trying to do day-to-day stuff. Following stimulation, study participants were more accurate in their questions about the content of the video clips, such as, what was the color of shirt was the actor who went out and took the garbage out? What was he wearing? What color shirt? Or was there a tree in the background? Additional, the study found that brain stimulation led to a higher quality reinstatement of memories. Reinstatement is when the brain can replay or relive an original event. So following the stimulation, the brain activity while watching a video looked more like their brain activity when they were remembering the video. We all know that memory can be mental time travel, and we have all probable experienced the circumstances. We're in an emotionally threatening situation. I can remember a car accident I had at the age of 16, and I can still tell you who was in the car with me, you know, what color was the car that I hit, stuff like that. How well do you remember those accidents? Probably a lot better than you remember the day before or the day after, because the emotional augmentation leads to a better memory trace. This is also exploited all the time by advertising. If you can evoke an emotion, whether it's lust or fear, those being the two best, anger works pretty well too. You get better memory and more truthiness of the statement. And that's been shown also in this. So the brain imaging was done with something called multivoxel pattern analysis, and they measured the effect of stimulation with the testing that I've just described. And I guess the thing to add is that during the memory test, there were a lot of video clips, and then they had to describe them and then answer a bunch of true-false questions on the video. And the number of questions that were answered correctly was definitely helped with the magnetic stimulation, but also, more importantly, you got a more lifelike brain pattern. And I'm sure if they had people recall their trauma, they would see that as well. But of course, we don't have a comparator, so that's extremely important. Having more reliable measures of this network could really help us understand memory loss. And, you know, let's just say that the potential for technology here, I mean, right now, transcranial magnetic brain stimulation is a big device. As I understand it, the U.S. military has been using electrical brain stimulation, which is very similar, in a helmet to improve the aim of Army sharpshooters. And I remember reading an article by a reporter who put one of those on and got lots of bullseyes, even though she had no experience with target practice. So we have got the beginnings of real neurological augmentation. And that is most exciting. Now, one of the most important things that happens to a developing fetus is that whole growing a healthy brain part, right? Well, healthy heart's good. Healthy brain, really important. Some of that brain growth in embryological development is structural. Remember Zika, which inhibited the formation, the closure of the neural tube, and therefore led to children being born, in some cases, without a brain. Also a structural factor is diet, a diet that's high in DHA, a type of omega-3 fatty acid, is very important, and there have been studies showing that you can kick the kid up a few IQ points by a diet high in fish, as long as the fish is not high in mercury. I always recommend that my pregnant patients use good quality form of fish oil that's heavy on the DHA, about 1,000 milligrams a day is good, and make sure that is tested, that every batch is tested for lead and mercury, mercury being the one we're most worried about with fish oil. Most of the higher quality products are screened, but it's important to check with the manufacturer. And definitely don't buy the bargain basement stuff without checking. But there's other factors, such as environmental toxins and pollutants, which also endanger proper development. You may recall the story that I gave you 5 years ago, I think, it's quite a while back, about measuring cord blood for plastic byproducts like phthalates, which is a softener that used to be in pacifiers. Well, it turns out that the mother's levels of these quote-unquote hormone mimics, sometimes called hormone disruptors, but I think that's a little political, so I just like to say, well, it's mimicking hormones, and we shouldn't be doing that because we don't know how to drive this vehicle. Anyway, you can measure the distance in the genitalia of a young baby boy, and it correlates directly with how much plastic was in the cord blood, how much plastic byproducts were there, correlates with a more female-like genitalia. And if you can see it on the outside, I just have to wonder what's going on the inside. So scientists at Columbia University, recognizing this, developed a method of using a DNA biomarker to more easily screen pregnant women for harmful environmental contaminants and things like air pollution, which has also been linked to developmental disorders, because those tiny little particles, the ones that you can only get rid of with a HEPA filter, those cross the placenta and they get into the bloodstream and they get into the mother's brain, but also that developing fetal brain. But nobody has really used DNA markers. Now, we've known that environmental factors like these air pollutants do change methylation on the DNA. So there are epigenetic flags, but no one's actually gone and linked it. So in this recent study published in the journal Epigenetic, a early warning system, a sort of profile that predicts which children are at highest risk for adverse health outcomes, has been developed. The researchers created, or identified more accurately, an accessible biomarker that can be measured in a very small amount of blood and used to distinguish newborns at birth for elevated risk due to prenatal exposure. And some of that they may not have been aware of. They used air pollution as a case study, but they could be easily generalized to other environmental exposures, such as the BPA and plastics I've been talking about. How did they do this? Well, that's where AI comes in. They used machine learning analysis of umbilical cord blood collected through two New York City-based longitudinal birth cohorts. So two different cohorts that were looking at development of the children. And so we have a long, deep core through time, and we can correlate that with test scores, we can correlate it with health status, growth curves, all sorts of things. And so these are extremely valuable databases to be examined like this. So they looked at DNA methylation, and study participants that had known levels of air pollution because they wore personal and ambient air monitoring during pregnancy. That was part of the study. And they specifically measured fine particulate matter and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. They found biomarkers for both of these, and they could be used with a decent amount of accuracy. And they could use cord blood to infer prenatal environmental exposure in women. So they had women measured. They could see the markers. How many markers did they have? And this is really going to help us develop an additional sort of newborn test that we can do that may help us identify children when they're high risk and possibly do interventions. Now, we know that about 15% of children in the United States between 3 and 17 have neurodevelopmental disorders. 15, that's 15%. So that includes things like ADHD, learning disabilities, autism, and a bunch of other developmental delays. We also know that the prevalence of childhood asthma is 8% in African-American boys, and we know that that's correlated with environmental pollution. There's also the possibility that we may be finding multiple preventable disorders that are related to both air pollution. Some research suggests that obesity, which is an epidemic in our children, may have links to this. So many things to think about here. Let's move on to another article. We're going to switch topics a little bit. This isn't about the brain. We're going to close on the possible solution to one of the rather odd mysteries that confronted us in the last few years. Last year, I should say. Almost exactly the last year. And that's convalescent serum in COVID-19. Now, convalescent serum, as you'll recall, has a long history. They were doing this stuff back in the 1930s. Somebody gets a disease, you take out their blood, spin off the red blood cells so it doesn't cause an immune reaction, and give it back to people who have just gotten the disease with the belief that that serum's going to be full of antibodies and you can help out the person who is got an acute case of the disease by giving them antibodies. And so this was done as early as December back in Wuhan and has been tried multiple times. And initially in New York and Milan and places like that, it looked like it was sort of working. But then as better research got done with placebo trials, it got gradually less helpful. But again, there's nuance. So the studies that showed that convalescent serum was good tended to be studies that included people who received it very early. And this is, now that we have the monoclonal antibodies, that's what they have turned out to be as well. If you give them early, they work because the disease is still getting rolling and you can help the person catch up to the disease and defeat it. But it only works if you can stop the initial geometric progression. Well, that makes sense. The mystery is, why does convalescent plasma given to people who have more advanced COVID actually appear to make them substantially worse? Well, I think the mystery may be solved. This was sent to me by one of my patients. It comes from the Annals of Rheumatic Diseases. And it was a letter. It was in the letter section. Let's see. It came out in June of 2020. So earlier studies had also reported that autoantibodies went up. So you got more anti-cardiolipin. That's a procoagulant. You got more lupus anticoagulant and anti-beta 2 GPI. These are all antibodies that are associated with thromboembolic complications in people who have them. That one patient, one of the ones I mentioned earlier, who spent a month in the ICU, she had this lupus anticoagulant and went into a massive, massive multiple clotting event. She just kept clotting, and the surgeon kept removing the clots, and she kept re-clotting. It was a very bizarre phenomenon. In this paper that's described here, this was an early paper where they had severely ill patients with SARS-CoV-2 in Greece. And they tested them for all of the autoantibodies, including the lupus antibody, ANCA, which is seen in inflammatory bowel disease and many other autoimmune diseases. Basically, just about all of the things that you might get on a general rheumatological fishing expedition. And they found that many of these patients were positive for autoantibodies without having a history of self-immunization in the past, but it was because of the fact that they had COVID. So about 68, almost 70% were positive for some kind of antibody when they had advanced or severe disease. And it's not really all that surprising because they have all those cytokines. Remember cytokine storm? Well, a cytokine storm lifts all boats, so to speak, and so all of your antibody levels are stimulated to rise, including previous autoantibodies that were being held in check by the immune regulatory system. So when we infuse convalescent plasma into a person who is very sick with COVID, we're not just giving them COVID antibodies, we're giving them an autoimmune disease. And we're also giving them a truckload, well, we're giving them antibodies against their own tissue. Some of these are highly pro-coagulant, and maybe this accounts for almost universality of coagulation complications in COVID-19. So a couple of fun stories just to close off the hour. The stinky fish gene. A small number of humans are born with a genetic quirk that makes them immune to the pungent smell of rotting fish, a whiff that they might actually even mistake for caramel or rose. This study came out in, it was a biogenetic study in Iceland. Interesting about Iceland, they had 11,000 participants and they were asked to smell six synthetic odors: cinnamon, peppermint, banana, licorice, lemon, and rotten fish. They then had to identify the smell and rate its intensity or pleasantness. Most patients correctly recognized the fish and gave it a low ranking for pleasantness, but about 2% consistently misidentified and even liked the fishy smell. These people, when they are genetically tested, all had a genetic mutation that disables a gene called TAAR5. Apparently, that gene helps us recognize a chemical that's found in rotten fish, poop, and other assorted yucky, gross things. The researchers think that the proportion of people with the TAAR5 mutation may be higher than the rest of the planet in Iceland. And you know what the chief protein source in Iceland is? Yeah, it's fish. So this recent study is a good indicator of how your dietary circumstance over several thousand years will shape your genetics. You might be selecting for a gene that allows you to eat somewhat rotten fish. You might be selecting, in the case of other Northern Europeans and some Africans, a gene that allows you to continue to digest milk into adulthood because now you have increased your food supply. In fact, that is true, and the gene happened twice, once in Africa in one spot on the lactase enzyme DNA, and once in Northern Europe on another. And it happened at different times as the dietary possibilities shift. And it doesn't take long, a couple thousand years in a small self-contained population, and the evolutionary advantage becomes apparent. We are constantly being shaped, and we are constantly shaping. It's a fantastic, interesting place out there. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.